Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Sometimes the only witness is the one they silenced. You're listening to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer.
The Delphi case, it is back in the news as the appeal process begins. Richard Allen's defense team filing a motion to correct errors, highlighting a 2017 confession from another suspect that was allegedly overlooked. This confession includes specific details about the crime, such as the use of a box cutter. Joining us is retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, host of the podcast Break the Case, available wherever you get podcasts, and a video version on YouTube, which is very good. I watched a little bit before we went on the air here. Jennifer, with your extensive expertise in federal investigations and everyone you know and have talked to, how critical is it for law enforcement to thoroughly vet confessions like this, and what impact on neglecting this could it have on a case? I mean, obviously, we see an impact here already.
Well, okay, when it comes to this case and Judge Gold's track record in her rulings, which have been almost 100% against any defense motion, I don't think this is going anywhere. But that's really not the point. The point is they must get this on the record.
Yeah.
And the other point is when it comes to third-party culprit defenses, you literally cannot throw mud against the fence. Just because you're the one facing a murder charge, you can't just say, no, you know what? It was Tom, Dick, and Harry. Mm-hmm. Or it was Chloe the dog and a police officer. Right? I mean, that's why judges are not going to let in those types of defenses. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they have an affidavit signed by a FBI agent that listed all sorts of probable cause factual information pointing at Ron Logan, another individual. Mm-hmm. And now we have a confession that Ron Logan made. And so when you add that all up, it just does not equal, in my opinion, supposition or rumors. There's actual meat to the bone. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the biggest, factor that could get this case overturned on appeal. What was not allowed in terms of third-party defense. And then secondarily, now, of course, we know about this confession, and the fact that they weren't allowed to bring any of this in is mind-boggling. I don't know if Richard Allen committed this crime or not. I just believe in the interest of justice, you have to be able to put up a defense and let the jury decide.
When we're talking about this 2017 alternate suspect confession, I've been looking to try and figure out who this is. This Ron Logan that they're referring to?
It's Ron Logan.
Okay. So Ron Logan confesses to authorities? Who is he confessing this to?
No, he actually confessed when he was behind bars to somebody else. So again, the jury, I believe, should have had an opportunity to weigh that. And Judge Gold is going to weigh that. And I think Judge Gold is going to say, no, but remember when he makes this confession, which is shortly after the crime and certainly before a lot of facts were known, he talks about how they were murdered. Mm-hmm. And he talks about a box cutter, which now we know from the testimony that the ME has sort of circled back and said, no, there weren't two weapons used. He thinks it was a box cutter. And I think the reason that was confusing probably was the difference in degree of severity in their necks. Mm-hmm. Which my understanding is Libby's was very rigid. Deep. Yeah. Horrible, and Abby's was smoother, but then the ME kind of doubled back on that and said, no, I think it might be a box cutter would explain that. And so here you have Ron Logan saying it was a box cutter that he used. And you have Ron Logan saying, if you're to believe this person, you know, that they were killed by being they're having their throats slit.
Yeah.
I mean, these are important details.
It goes back to the why. Why did Judge Gull not think that this was important? Because they couldn't get Ron Logan back in there and they couldn't have their boogeyman to put away in a court of law. I guess why? I don't know. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me when you have these things that took place and you have all the, I mean, beyond Ron Logan, too, you got Keegan Klein, who was into the child porn and planned on meeting them that day, allegedly even communicated with one of them prior to this. And that's like, well, yeah, you're in jail for something else and you have an alibi at that time. The odds of that being that he has nothing to do with this seem nearly impossible. There's so many of these people. Why? Just why did Judge Gull not take any of these things into consideration?
Well, I think Judge Gull felt like maybe Ron Logan wouldn't be convicted if it came in. I mean, I hate to say that because I have the utmost respect for judges, any judge I've ever come across in cases all these years, 28 years, I've only had the highest respect for the judges that I've worked with. They're amazing. And so, you know, I hate to say that, but just seeing all the roadblocks go up, I just wonder if she lost her sense of fairness. You know, in other words, of truly being fair, where you let both sides present their case and you let a jury decide. Once you start pulling out all the facts that could be presented on behalf of one side, how is that fair? Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. You mentioned Keegan Klein. Keegan Klein was literally in communication through their pseudo person, Anthony Schatz, with Libby about meeting. And it's always, you know, why did they want to go there? To meet up and to walk that day. I shouldn't say to meet up. And why was he there? Why was Richard Allen? I mean, if you really look at this, was this just so lucky? Was Richard Allen just the luckiest killer in the world that these two girls happened to be there when he just happened to be there and never, no criminal history, nothing. And he just happened to kill him?
Yeah.
It's really, and have the tools he needed. You know, walking around with a box cutter and a gun. There were so many answers or questions that were left unanswered. And this case will really bother me. Not because, you know, I don't know whether he's guilty or innocent. I just don't think the jury had all the information to work with to make a decision.
How do you think an appellate court is going to look at all of this, all these things that they're bringing to the attention now, all these missteps? Are we very much looking at a very high likelihood of another trial for Richard Allen? And then I got to follow up on that one after.
I don't know, Tony. I say that because it depends on one of the biggest things is who is the quality of the appellate attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've petitioned for one. They're going to get one, but it's going to be a public defender, appellate attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And not that they're saying there's anything wrong with that, because they typically are the most experienced. I tell you, if I were ever in trouble, I would probably want a public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're so experienced. But having said that, it just is really going to depend on that, I think, in large part. You know, this is one of the rarest cases I've ever seen, because you had a trial judge, Judge Gull, remove the attorneys for the defendant and get overturned
mm-hmm.
by the Supreme or by the Indiana Supreme Court right before trial. That was critical. That showed you, even though they said it quite nicely, that, you know, he was being denied a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And that was such a blow, I think, all based on the fact that crime scene photos were released, the defense is the last people normally that want any crime scene photos out there. Mm-hmm. You know, even in court, the prosecutor is always the one that wants to get crime scene photos in the face of the jury. And the defense is always the one saying, no, it's too prejudicial. When they see what happened to these girls, they're going to definitely want to convict our man. Mm-hmm. And so why in the world would the defense have been motivated? And we know that Rossi, it wasn't even his office. Mm-hmm. He wasn't anywhere around this file. And the person who took them pled guilty, signed an affidavit, and was charged and convicted for the crime mm-hmm. of taking these photos, releasing them, and then that person released them, and then they got in the hands of creators who then, you know, turned them over. But for the most part, you know, they're still floating around out there. So obviously everybody who got them did not turn them over. But my point is on this is even the Supreme Court has overruled her. So I just think there's some glaring issues, and I'm hopeful it's just fair.
Yeah. That's, I think, what everybody wants. I still come from the same camp, too, of I don't know if he's guilty, but it certainly wasn't a fair and just trial. It was not how we do trials in this country. I mean, there's so many things that are being argued here with the defense of the prosecutorial misconduct and fixing these errors and such that are just fact. It's not even like up for debate. Like, how do you interpret how this happened? This is what happened. He was denied this. They didn't do that. They took his attorneys away here. They erased evidence over there. Some of their testimony made little to no sense in terms of a timeline. And on that, the white van, the defense alleging that the prosecution presented or failed to correct the false testimony regarding the white van in this case that was linked to the crime. And if that could be proven, it could undermine the credibility of the prosecution and effectively impact the verdict. How do you think that will score in terms of an appellate court where their van timeline was kind of all over the place?
Yeah, it was wonky. It was wonky from the beginning. And a lot of that information regarding that van was all over social media. I've always said that. Mm-hmm. And but I think it is important to remember that we're not even at the appellate stage.
No, we're
this
not.
This is just before Judge Gohl. Just for clarity that, you know, to vacate the verdict, basically the defense, and this is just routine, is saying, listen, look at all of these issues. You need to vacate. The chances of that happening, I would bet everything I own that will never, ever happen. There is no way that she's going to vacate anything. The only chance for Richard Allen is years and years down the line if an appeal is brought and accepted. And I think it could be. Tony, did you get a chance to listen to one of the jurors who talked about the fact that really the tipping point, and I think they deliberated, I want to say 5 days, mm-hmm. I believe.
It was around there.
Was right around there. It wasn't quick. It wasn't in hours like you see oftentimes. And it was the confessions. You know, everything else they seem to, at least this juror, that's what this juror said. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the fact, and you and I have talked about this so often, that he was in a maximum security prison locked up for 23 hours. And this is what one of the issues they're saying, that there wasn't even an attorney present to represent him when those decisions were made.
Yeah.
Later, obviously, they came back and the judge said motion denied, motion denied, motion denied. So I'm not sure it's going to have legs because it was later argued by his attorneys they shouldn't be there. But that is the genesis, I believe, of those confessions. In other words, right now, if you put Brian Koberger, accused of the Idaho murders, in a maximum security for 23 hours, would he go crazy?
Yeah, I think anybody would. Anybody. You can put somebody who you know was not involved in a crime and leave them in maximum security for about a year and go and see what person you have once you take him out of that cage and what they're going to say. It might be kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said compare how he, the written confession that he gave, to how he wrote, it was in writing, right? To yeah. how he wrote when he was being interrogated and interviewed when he wasn't in custody. I mean, he's extremely, you know, he wrote well. Mm-hmm. He made his points. It was very cohesive to understand. That gibberish that was put forth was gibberish. And I'm not trying to say we saw the exact exhibit, but there was a reporter that wrote it exactly as they saw it, you know, meandering words and up in the right hand words all over, and how it was. I mean, it looks like somebody under the influence, and we know he was medicated, and he was highly medicated with psychotropic type drugs to sedate him and things. And I will never understand the genesis of how he was ever allowed to be in those conditions and the result. I'll never be able to understand that, because there's no other case like that.
No. I mean, that in itself was where we were saying, okay, he gets a, get a new trial free card with that. And the fact that, yes, he was, take, if we're, if you take the, just the psychological damage that you're going to do to somebody by putting them into a confined space like that, which people like to pretend, oh, nothing happens, he's just not that strong. No, it does damage. But you have the medicated end of this as well, too. You can't sign legal documents if you are under the influence of some sort of psychotropic medication. They're going to say, not valid. But he can make meandering statements of, I killed them. Probably just his mind is saying, I'll say anything to get the hell out of here at this point. And they're saying, that's totally valid. It's not going to be valid if he wants to sign over here to buy a Buick. But it's totally valid if he signs, if he makes these statements and doesn't have to sign anything. We're just going to say it's all true. It works. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I will say, though, the jury did get to know at least some of the background. But remember, a lot of that was not allowed to come forward.
Yeah.
A lot of information surrounding the conditions and other things. But they at least got to look at the, you know, confessions. And I think the bottom line is what most people think is, who in the world, if they would were innocent, would make all these confessions? But as I said, the confessions needed to have something that no one knew, you know, something that wasn't in the public. And they didn't, other than this piece about the van. But again, that was in the public, and he got all discovery.
Yeah, he had knowledge of it. It wasn't like it was some hidden thing that he's throwing into the conversation that no one else would know about. Yeah, it's fascinating. We're at the very beginning process of this part of it, and I think we'll probably be talking about this for years. Just so frustrating.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
All right, true crime addicts, let's cut the crap. You're knee-deep in the gory details of your favorite podcast when suddenly a commercial hits like a bad meal. Seriously? You deserve better. Upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, where you can binge without those annoying ads. Plus, get extended interviews that go deeper into the darkness and early access to episodes so you can be the first to know. It's like trading up from fast food to fine dining, but with more blood. So, go ahead, search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and feast on the good stuff.